There's been an increase in homicides, especially related to gun violence in the last couple years, after a big decline in that kind of violence from a peak back in the 1990s. A lot of that is driven by violence in cities. When we talk about solutions to urban violence, we often talk about root causes: poverty, lack of social mobility, economic and racial inequality. Or we talk about things like drugs and the challenges of law enforcement. Our next guest says those are important factors in the long run, but he says there are more direct, proven interventions that can turn the tide on urban violence more quickly and make it easier to tackle some of those long-term problems, too. We're talking now about urban violence, especially gun violence, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your loved ones or your neighborhood been affected by urban violence? Do you have a story to share? How do you think policymakers should address urban violence, which overwhelmingly affects poor people of color? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas Apt is a senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice and author of the book Bleeding Out: The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've seen this uptick in urban violence in a number of cities across the U.S. this year. First of all, can we define the phrase, the kind of violence you're focusing on, and what do we mean by the phrase urban violence?
Sure. When we're talking about urban violence, we also call it sort of community violence, or, it's the sort of intersection of gang, gun, youth, street violence. And each one of those terms sort of emphasizes a different aspect. But this type of violence is the violence that occurs between and among mostly young men without a lot of opportunity or many options. And so these are young men who are among the most disenfranchised in our society, and they mostly live in poor communities of color in our nation's cities.
And you use a metaphor for urban violence of a person bleeding from a gunshot wound in the emergency room when it comes to how we prioritize treatment. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely. It's very well understood that high rates of crime and violence are the unfortunate legacy of decades, if not centuries, of racial segregation, persecution, disinvestment, and other things. And so there are structural factors at play here. But at the same time, everything we know about the science of violence reduction says you have to address it directly. And so in the book, I have this metaphor of a young man who has been shot and is literally bleeding out on an emergency room operating table. And my point is that to save the young man's life, you don't get him a GED, you don't find him a steady job, and you don't deal with his housing. You do the first, most immediate, most urgent thing, which is you stop the bleeding so that you can save the young man's life. And that's the metaphor that I believe we need to, that's the same urgency with which we need to address the issue of urban violence in our nation's cities. We need to address it directly.
How do we do that? What is the equivalent in that metaphor of that surgical intervention? What is that direct intervention that's going to help stop gun violence without having to solve all the long-term causes first?
Sure. As difficult and chronic and persistent as the phenomenon of urban gun violence is, there is some good news in this area, which is that the phenomenon of gun violence is extremely concentrated. It's very sticky. It clusters together among a surprisingly small number of people, places, and behaviors. In any given city, there's a small network of individuals who are at the highest risk for gun violence, and that's a fraction of 1% of the city's population. And at the same time, we also know that, 4 to 5 to 6% of city blocks are going to generate 60 to 70 to 80% of the most deadly violence. And so the key thing to understand is that you need to have a hyper-concentrated approach to this issue and not stigmatize whole neighborhoods or whole classes of people. You need to really be quite focused.
Talking to Thomas Apt, author of Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. You can join in with your comments or questions for our guest about urban violence and how to prevent it at 800-642-1234. Let's start with the people most likely to be involved in violence. How do we identify them in a way that isn't, you know, a broad approach that, as you say, is stereotyping a bunch of people? And then how do we reach out to them to prevent them getting involved in escalating violence?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the first thing is that the people who are involved and are at the highest risk for either being a perpetrator of gun violence or a victim, because in this world of gun violence, today's victim is tomorrow's perpetrator and vice versa. It's not hard to identify these individuals. They're well known to law enforcement. They're well known to their own communities. And they've been involved in the criminal justice system and in the juvenile justice system for most of their lives. Many of them have multiple felony records. They've often been violently injured and shot multiple times in the past. And so this isn't sort of a needle in the haystack phenomenon. These are people who are persistently engaged and trapped in these cycles. And so identifying them is not hard, but helping them get out of these deeply entrenched sort of habits and behaviors is really challenging, because these are young men and sometimes not so young men who are really in crisis. You know, the science says that, yes, we have to make sure that they understand that they have to be accountable for the dangers that they pose to the community. But we also have to give these young men an alternative, something to say yes to. We have to provide them with some stability, offers of treatment to help them change the way they think and change their patterns, and then ultimately opportunities.
Do you have examples in mind of communities that have done this kind of approach and seen good results?
Sure. One of the best examples is in the city of Oakland. Many of your listeners might know that Oakland has been one of the most violent cities in the United States for decades. And it also has a particularly difficult history of police-community relationships. The Black Panthers were created in Oakland in response to police violence. And so Oakland is a very difficult place to operate and to make good policy work. But almost 10 years ago, the city launched this effort called Operation Ceasefire. And Operation Ceasefire, or Oakland Ceasefire, is a focused deterrent strategy, a strategy that's been used around the country. And the strategy essentially creates a partnership between police, community members, and service providers. And this partnership then identifies the individuals and the groups at the highest risk for violence, and then engages them directly and speaks to them. And they basically offer a very simple message. They say, the violence is unacceptable and it has to stop. If you'll let us, we'll help you. But if you make us, we'll stop you. And they combine this approach of both empathy and accountability. And they offer services and supports and assistance. But for those who persist in violence, there's targeted enforcement and prosecution.
Let's bring on a caller. Go ahead.
And I should just give the results. The results of this program in Oakland were approximately 50% reduction in gun violence over the span of 6 years. And this strategy has been effective in other places as well. The key question is not whether we can be successful. The question is, can we sustain that success?
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tomas is with us in Madison. Tomas, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Given that there are generally understood to be equal rates of drug use between communities of color and the white community, and the disproportionate jailing and arrest of people of color, how much violence strife in the those communities of color can be attributed to over-policing, as well as the problematic culture of police departments that have been pretty well documented infiltration of those departments by white supremacists.
Tomas, thanks for the call. Some of that connects to what you were saying about Oakland and lack of trust, given the history of the police department there. What do you think of Thomas's point, Thomas?
I think it's an interesting point. I think that clearly the police play an important role in violence reduction, and when they don't play that role effectively, violence can increase. I think that, and also I think there's an important question sort of underneath what Tomas said, which is the underlying legitimacy of law enforcement. And when people don't believe in their law enforcement, they simply don't use it. And so what the research shows is that when people don't trust their local law enforcement, they don't call 911, they don't serve as jurors, and they won't offer information. And that can lead all of those simmering conflicts in a neighborhood, which might be resolved nonviolently by resorting to the police. Sometimes those rivalries escalate and turn violent. And so one thing you can see is controlling for other factors. Communities that have very low levels of trust in the police are generally more violent than others.
We're picking up our talk now with Tomas Apt, senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, author of Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. He says there are proven targeted interventions that can focus on the people and places most at risk of gun violence if we're willing to stick with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have questions, or maybe an experience to share. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas, you mentioned a key part of this with any solution, sustainability. And I know I've talked to people who have worked with groups, violence interrupting and things like that, that seem to have found promising early results and then budgets get leveled out or cut. What does it take once you find an effective solution like this to make sure that the people who spend the money stick with it?
Well, it's a really interesting and difficult political challenge. One thing you see in many cities that's documented in my book is successful strategies to control community violence, driving violence down, having significant success. But then once violence returns to a sort of acceptable lower rate, then the commitment leaves, and politicians have other priorities, people leave, funding wanes, and then the violence goes back up. And so one of the key questions is, how can we stop this back and forth where we where violence escalates, we temporarily do what is necessary to reduce violence, but then as soon as violence goes down, we ease up, we lose our commitment, and then the cycle starts all over again.
Is it hard to sell this kind of nuanced approach? Because there are a lot of really easy to formulate ideas out there on how to fix this problem, whether it's more police and more arrests, fewer guns in communities, things like that. Is it hard to go to a policymaker who might have some kind of partisan pressure from one side or another and sell these kind of ideas?
It is. The simplest way I can summarize the research and my colleagues and I have summarized or synthesized over 1,400 individual impact evaluations on reducing violence. The simplest way that I can summarize it is that successful anti-violence strategies have three qualities. They're focused, meaning they focus on the highest risk people and places. They're balanced in that they offer both carrots and sticks. They include both enforcement and prevention. And finally, that they're fair, meaning that they're perceived to be legitimate by the impacted individuals and impacted communities that they work with. Those are the three key qualities. But it's very hard to push through the sound bites on this issue. These strategies are not particularly conservative. They're not particularly progressive. So they don't really fit in either political party's sort of readily accessible toolbox. Also, they're a little bit more complicated to explain than just get all the guns off the street or give everybody jobs, those sort of soundbite types of answers. And finally, I think we have to acknowledge the role of race. This type of community violence impacts the most disenfranchised people in our society. And if this violence was impacting another segment of the population, I think there would be more political will to address it. And you can see this in the way the gun violence debate is distorted. We spend an enormous amount of time, energy, and attention on mass shootings. And mass shootings are undeniably important, but they cause a fraction of the deaths that are caused by urban violence.
Talking to Thomas Apt, author of the book Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. You've mentioned, Thomas, the importance of community involvement in these programs. It'd be easy for a police agency or a local government or violence researchers, say, to show up with the plan that's going to solve everything. How important is it to have the affected community be at the table?
I believe it's essential, and I think that the research backs that up. Ultimately, you can impose a short-term solution on a community, but if you're going to have success over the long run, you really need community members fully at the table, fully participating. And that means they need to be engaged from the beginning and be involved in the policymaking process. Now, I don't believe that it's fair to sort of ask community members to sort of make up a solution, out of whole cloth. But I do believe that you need to go to the community, present them with a series of options and say, here's a few options. They're backed by science. We think they could possibly work. Which of these options do you think would work best in this community? And how would you customize these options? I think that's the way you start the conversation.
When it comes to selling some of these ideas to people who are maybe aren't now part of that community, getting back to the person outside of the most affected areas who may be wondering, why should I care? You spell out the human costs in your book and your other work. Can you also talk about the financial costs of the kinds of violence we're talking about?
Sure. You know, these strategies don't cost a lot of money. So it's not like we have to mobilize a massive movement in society to get support for them. If we get enough people, a small group of people lobbying for these, they can get the funds necessary to do these things. How do we reach those people? Sometimes you reach them through their heads, and sometimes you reach them through their hearts. In terms of their heads and the dollars involved, the sort of most credible estimates suggest that society pays anywhere between $10 and $19 million in total cost per homicide. And that's not just the direct costs of incarceration, court costs, law enforcement costs, medical costs, but it's also the cost of all the fear and avoidance caused by violence in society. That translates into increased insurance premiums, higher taxes, and very importantly, diminished property values.
That brings things back around to our starting point to some extent on the longer term root causes of violence. Does making these neighborhoods most affected by gun violence safer, is that going to help tackle problems like poverty and some of those other root cause issues?
I think it's a great question. Many people talk about how there are root causes to this violence and things like poverty, inequality, and lack of opportunity. And that is absolutely correct. But what not enough people talk about is that that same relationship exists in reverse, meaning that high rates of violence are actually perpetuating poverty, inequality, and lack of opportunity in these neighborhoods. And one of the ways this happens is through the deeply traumatic impact of being exposed to violence. And you can see this most clearly with kids. Kids, study after study shows that when kids are exposed to violence, either as victims or as witnesses, it traumatizes them and it impacts their ability to sleep, to focus, to behave, and to learn. And what happens to children who can never escape this violence because they live in a violent context in a violent neighborhood? Well, ultimately, it translates to significantly diminished academic performance, which ultimately impacts their ability to get a good job. High rates of urban violence are literally trapping poor kids in poverty, and it's important to recognize that.
I want to take just our last minute. I believe you've had your eye on budget proposals from the Biden administration when it comes to crime and criminal justice issues. Are you seeing attention to the sorts of things you say we need to see in our cities?
Yes, I'm quite pleased to see the Biden administration, as part of the American Jobs Plan, including $5 billion with a B, dollars for community-based, evidence-based violence reduction programs, programs that have a history of effectively driving homicides and other forms of gun violence down. That is a remarkable level of investment that we've never seen before. But we have to remember that this is just a proposal. Congress still has to pass this plan. And as we all know, as many people know, this is going to be negotiated over. And so we don't know that $5 billion will actually end up in any legislation. So we need to keep the pressure on Congress. But I am encouraged that the administration is taking this issue seriously.
Thomas, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Thomas Apt, senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, author of the book Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence, and A Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets.